I'm John B.
I'm Kevin H.
And I'm Jim, and this is Topic Lore, is the only place on the internet you can hear topics discussed. John, would you like to introduce yourself, or do you have anything to plug?
I'm John B. I'm some guy. I plug dog ownership.
Yeah? Is that working out for you?
Yeah. Some on the Topic Lore's Discord may know we recently had to say goodbye to the first dog I had in my adult life.
Yeah.
Since he was a puppy. He lived a good long life, but it was a little sudden. He'd been healthy up until then. And, you know, we're unsure what life is going to be like, you know, trying to imagine our lives after that. And then a week later, we got another dog. So,
okay.
And it's worked out great.
Problem solved.
Yeah. He's adorable. He's the same in many ways, different in many ways. Just kind of what you could hope for.
Yeah.
It's so cool having a living creature that just wanders around a house. It's such a strange and wonderful thing.
It's weird, you know? Isn't it?
Yeah.
It's super weird that we do this, like they just hang around here. And it's not like the other creatures that we don't want in the house.
Yeah. Cats can be both, but
that's true.
And I still consider myself a cat person as much as in love of dogs I am now, but yeah.
Yep.
It's amazing the way dogs communicate with each other and with human beings. It's pretty great. But yeah, good times, good pictures, silliness, all around recommended. Picking a poop, if you're worried about that, is not as bad as you'd expect.
If you're one of those people who really like wants an opportunity to pick up something like poop, warm, soft, weird things, like dog ownership is second to none.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the warm is actually better than the cold, I find. We live in an apartment and sometimes picking up, you know, the cold ones that other dogs have left behind, you know, just as service is
cracking open a cold one.
Yeah, exactly. Don't do it all the time, but occasionally, you know, they have maintenance that picks it up and stuff, but you know, courtesy, your dog's playing in there in the dog park. You want to keep it clean. So for some reason that's worse. I'm not sure why.
I would imagine it's a lot like, you know, you're wiping your son's butt when you're changing his diaper.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you expect like, oh, this is going to be like the grossest thing I've ever done, but it's just whatever. You get used to it extremely quickly because this creature is very important to you.
Yes. Yeah. You love them.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Imagine that. Yeah. Dogs are great. Go check out some dogs.
Kevin, would you like to introduce yourself or do you have anything to plug?
Yeah, I'll reintroduce myself and then I guess plug the thing that I've been working on. I'm Kevin. I'm a professor at the University of Arizona. I'm an astronomer and work on NASA's flagship space telescope, JWST. The last time I talked, the telescope had been launched. It was doing pretty well, but none of the science data had come down. It's now been 2 years since that. And man, we are flushed with science data and it's really very exciting. So I'd like to plug the project I work on, which is JADES, which is the Advanced Deep Extragalactic Survey, which is the deepest image that human beings have ever taken. This incredibly bountiful field of the sky that we've imaged with more filters than anyone else has, like to depths that are like, you know, unprecedented. And more importantly, it's the field where, as of a couple of years ago, we found the farthest galaxy human beings have ever discovered, a galaxy called JADES GSC 130. And that's what I did. I did that. I found that. And so, you know, I'll put a link into that goes in the show notes, but you can, if you Google JADES survey, it's like ATM machine. You shouldn't have to say JADES survey, but Google will recognize. You'll find our website, jades-survey@github.io or whatever. And then you can click and look at the viewer, which will allow you to actually like Google Maps, just like look at all of our data. And it's really a very impressive amount of galaxies, hundreds of thousands of them. And I work on that team doing a lot of things, but one of them is finding faraway things and finding the distances to each of the individual galaxies. And so that's what I'd like to plug. I'd like to plug really incredible science data over the last couple of years, not just the beautiful images of nebula and you know, nearby planets and stars and stuff, but the really, really far away galaxies, like, you know, JADES GSC 13, the galaxy that we found a couple of years ago, is from just a couple hundred million years after the Big Bang, like 370 million years after the Big Bang. And so we're seeing it when the universe was really, really young. And then I'll say obliquely, I've been waiting for someone to break our record, find an even farther galaxy. And someone has, which is unfortunate. But what is fortunate is that person is me. And so we're writing a paper about a galaxy that's even farther that should come out within a month. Or if you're listening to us now, it may already be out. And you may have seen, hopefully, a press release about this galaxy, which is amazing.
Incredible. Love it.
You get the full gamut of experience here on Topic Lords.
I also clean up my cat's
dogs
poop.
And distant galaxies. Okay. All right.
But it's all Stardust.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all the same.
Yes.
Yeah. How readable is there like some good places to look at the data? That, like, how readable is it by like the lay educated individual?
So there are many, many articles about Jade's results in the press. I can point out to a couple. I'll put in the show notes or something, or send to Jim to put in the show notes, or send to Jim to just ignore. I don't know. Articles that are about some of the work that I've done. Like last year, I put out a paper that was like, here are the 700 plus farthest galaxies across our survey, of which like 90% had never been seen before. And that was in the press and a lot of people wrote about it. So I can post those. Those are pretty straightforward. My papers themselves are dry.
Yeah. Good. I'm glad there are some listicles out there that we can we can peruse.
Yeah. It's also just pretty cool to go through the survey in and of itself. Like just it's a very cool thing to just like peer at something that is effectively in the sky the size of like a grain of sand held at the end of your arm, but like just zoom in and go like, oh, each one of these is a galaxy. Each one of these is like hundreds of thousands or millions or hundreds of millions or hundreds of billions of stars, many, many suns, many like potentially billions and billions of planets. And to think about like the vast majority of the ones you're looking at here, like no one's ever really carefully looked at. You know, you could pick any one of them and go, you know what, if I were to look at this, Kevin, me, probably made a plot to show you and could tell you the distance and some other properties of it. But no one's really looked at that because when you have 100 billion of anything, it's hard to look at every individual one. And so you could become an expert. It's like the Name a Star Foundation that astronomers never use. If you want a galaxy, you can pick one of yourself and, you know, name it after yourself. I've just found one here on the website. And, you know, if anyone wants it, it's theirs. It's
that's an incredible service. You call it the Frog Fractions Galaxy.
Yeah, sure. I'll find a green one.
Bug Mars 2. Yeah, I think I mentioned it last time we were on, which I can't believe it's been 2 years. I mean, time's been flying. I'm sorry for not doing anything on my part to get you back on again.
That's okay.
Things happen. But yeah, I think I mentioned The Glass Universe last time, which is a great book about the project to map the sky at Harvard in the late 1800s, early 20th century. And, you know, even though it's a much cruder level, it's the same thing you're talking about, right? Just all this data, and you got to have somebody to look at it to find things, and things were found.
Yeah. Back then we didn't have like computers that could do it. So we just had to hire women and call them computers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Back before that, there just had to be a rich guy with a lot of free time.
Yeah.
Who just spent his time looking up.
Very rich and a lot of free time and a gold nose.
Right.
Yeah. A plug for that book, I guess. That's a great read.
Yeah. Those women there's a woman named Henrietta Swan Leavitt, and there's another book about her specifically. She was one of the Harvard astronomers, or computers, excuse me. And if she didn't do her work looking at all these data, she would not have figured out this thing that certain stars get brighter and dimmer on very specific periods that you can use to figure out how bright they are, which allowed Edwin Hubble in the 1920s, about 100 years ago, to discover the universe was expanding. So, you know, we're very indebted to women astronomers who were hired to just churn through data for being as smart as they were and doing a lot of pioneering work that in terms of shoulders of giants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are we ready for some topics?
I think so. I'm excited to not talk about JWST. That's the best thing.
Wait. Okay, I'm ready.
John, your topic is thoughts on approximately 5/12 of Don Quixote.
Oh, shit. I'm not ready. No, just kidding. Yeah. So, you know, I've been going through books over the last most of my life, but over the last few years, I've been hitting up some of the, you know, the classics in the canon. Like 2 years ago, I guess I read Little Women, Tristram Shandy, and some years before that, I read Moby Dick. You know, some adults, you know, take on this task. I feel like it's mostly the domain of like literature majors or people who did a lot of that in college, you know, really focused on that kind of thing. But public domain books still, you know, sell a lot. You know, you still find them at Barnes and Noble and everything. And different ones are more readable than others, which I'm finding out. But yeah, Tristram Shandy in particular kind of got me put Don Quixote on my radar for some time in the near future, because it was largely inspired by it and a couple other works that came before. Don Quixote is kind of like the first modern novel. It's weird because it's written in Shakespeare's time, and at least the translation I have, translation notes were very good. John Rutherford. So this is from like the year 2000, I think. So pretty recent translation. he's updated the language somewhat, but tried to maintain the spirit.
Yeah.
And you can tell, like, it's a very readable version that's very funny. And there's actually like a lot of poetry interspersed in is the style, among other things. So unfortunately, there aren't any notes on like the translation of the poetry in particular, you know, any extensive kind of notes like that on the translation, at least within the copy itself. But there are expected footnotes to explain kind of the obscure things or point out, you know, references and jokes. I really recommend that translation. It's like this one, and then there's one other one. I forget the woman's name who translated it, but those are kind of like the two competing modern translations. Most of the ones before that, there's like two or three that were popular, and they're revised versions of that, which those are like the public domain versions that most people know. But getting to the work itself, where do I begin?
It's hard in a book like Don Quixote for translation because it's like a book that has like a lot of plays on words and puns and stuff. And like, man, that's the task of a translator trying to like figure out a way in English to make it funny and to make it funny in the same sense.
Right.
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. The notes are great. And he gives a few, you know, like a handful of examples and other translations, things like that. He does a really good job of succinctly getting to his philosophy in a way that made me really trust the translation. It'd be interesting if I had the time to like go dig up and read another one. But the whole reason I chose this one is because I found it for $2, right? The best version to read is the reason you have. I wanted a paper copy, and I just stumbled on the used bookstore and grabbed it there for a couple bucks. Mm-hmm. He pays close attention to like giving characters different voices and things like that. Or, you know, when they're talking a certain way and Cervantes is talking a different way, you know, the narrator has his own voice and everything. So,
yeah.
But yeah, getting to the book itself, I'm finding it surprisingly readable, surprisingly funny, like immediately, in contrast with like Tristram Shandy, which is a great book with a lot of humor, but I know a lot of it I missed. Which is funny because it's in English, but because it's in English, nobody thinks to translate it.
Right.
Really?
Yeah. I've talked about this. That's very frustrating to me.
Yeah. The orthography might be updated. And it's a denser book. It came out, you know, 150 years later or something like that. And it really plays around with structure. Like if Don Quixote is modern, it's kind of like hyper modern for its time. So I'm finding it, you know, it's a long book, but it's a really easy read. And, you know, if you know the cultural touchstones, like most of them happen pretty early, like when he goes to fight the windmill and stuff.
Right.
You know,
is that how it is for a lot of totemic works? Is that because of the fact that people are going to fall off in the same way that I think a couple weeks ago you were talking about how in video games, some of the best stuff happens and like no one gets to play it because it's at the very end of the game. Like,
yeah.
Is it something where people go like, oh, he tilts at windmills because it's in the first like 20 pages. And they're like, that must be it. Great. And they just never get to page 4,000.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, there's obviously a lot more going on, but yeah, like a lot of the first part is, you know, he's convinced Sancho Panza to, you know, accompany him on this mad journey. And it's very clear he's crazy. Like they say it outright in the book. That's another thing. You know, it's not like it's not subtext. It's just text. Like this dude's brain is addled by the pop culture of his day. And like, I'm reading it and I'm thinking about like, man, you could do this like as a version, like of a total, like a North American otaku going around with his katana. Right. And so that really clicked with me. I'm like, you know, I'm starting to see all the connections with why quixotic is an adjective and like all the characters that come from that.
Can we camp out on that word for a second?
Sure.
I really want it to be pronounced quixotic.
Yeah.
In fact, I do pronounce it quixotic.
Yeah.
I know most people don't.
Yeah.
But
it's definitely quixotic.
No, it's not. No.
Okay. It's whatever you want it to be, but
okay. All right.
General I'll accept pronunciation that. Guides. I think have pronounced it quixotic, but
yeah.
That's how I first heard it. And
yeah, me too. But
the only people who use it are English majors. So you gotta,
no, I don't respect them.
Why would you put that in the show notes? We don't respect English majors. I want to get back to Don Quixote in a second, but can we all think of another book title where one of the names of the title has become like a common word that refers to things?
I mean, the closest thing is Kafkaesque that I come off.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You get certain authors, you get, you know.
I think Frankenstein, like this person's a Frankenstein, is like a combination.
Yeah, I like using that as a verb because why not verb the noun?
Faustian?
Faustian is a good one.
Was Through the Looking Glass the name of a book?
Yeah.
Or Through the Looking Glass here, people.
So that's like a phrase, yeah. It's just fun to think about, like, naming a character and being like, I hope people don't argue about the pronunciation of this in a word that is related to this character hundreds of years from now.
Oh, catch 22.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good one.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's really easy to get into. And like, I mean, a lot of it is concerned with chivalry. A lot of it's concerned with women staying virgins until they're married.
Yeah.
Which a lot of society was concerned with at the time. It's difficult to tell. You know, there are like parodic and commentary elements to the book, but it can be hard to tell what Cervantes' own view is. Is narrator a lot of the time on that stuff. It's hard to tell if it's background noise. It's hard to tell if he's doing a commentary on it. You know, I get the feeling that for that kind of stuff, it's kind of like, you know, it seems like he wouldn't be like overly concerned with it in terms of like life beyond just kind of the background noise of what society is, right? Yeah. It's hard to tell from translation and other things. Characters obviously have points of view and things like that, but it's, you know, it really just feels like mostly grist for the rest of the goings on. But yeah, connections to other literature, like immediately one of the first things I thought of was Beavis and Butthead, because quite honestly, they are a quixotic pair of characters. Like, mm-hmm. Butthead is Don Quixote and Beavis is Sancho Panza. Like, you have the one who's motivated to do the crazy thing and the one who follows him. And, you know, even Beavis will have a side sometimes, like, I don't know if this is such a good idea, Butthead. And, you know, Butthead will slap him and convince him. And that's, you know, there are scenes in the book that could be right out of a Beavis and Butthead episode. There's one time where they get so addled by some battle or they eat something bad and they end up throwing up on each other and things like that. It's, it's totally played for comedy a lot. And a little over 400 pages through, which is about 512 in the copy I have. Hence the topic. Actually, just back to Beavis and Butthead. And then the Great Cornholio himself is a quixotic figure inside of Beavis and Butthead.
He needs peepees like, for his bunghole.
He's literally driven crazy and he's tilting at windmills the whole time, right?
The influence of Cervantes. Go back to the man and ask him, did you know?
Yeah. Mike Judge is our modern Cervantes. Who'd have thought that? But yeah, I'm 512 in the last 100 pages. They've just been at an inn because there have been a couple like stories of other characters that are stopping by at the inn. So, you know, big Canterbury Tale vibes kind of going on there. Another book I haven't read and like is probably way harder to read because of the style language.
I'm looking at a translation on like Wikisource or whatever, and it's really fun because each chapter it's like as it is in books of this era, in which, and there's a in which are continued of the unheard of adventures of the inn.
Yeah, the chapter title. If you're just reading the table of contents, the chapter titles are, which I did. I like read most of the chapter titles before I started the book proper. It's pretty funny. But yeah, there's like 100 pages where they go to this inn, which they've been to before, and other characters show up. It's interesting because Quixote's pretty ridiculous at this point. And the translator goes into, there have actually been different interpretations. Like, this is probably one of the funnier translations. And like, there's a big tradition in the Romantic period when translators were doing it of really exalting, you know, kind of Quixote's valor and everything, you know. So it'd be interesting to go and compare. Like, I don't know if they just outright missed the jokes or things like that.
Yeah,
but there's a bit of a turn. It's like there's like this big dinner scene, and Don Quixote gives a speech to spoil the book just a little bit. I mean, you can't really spoil it. A bunch of these characters that show up have surprising connections to each other at this point. In a way, it feels like Quixote brings some of these characters to the inn. His whole series of adventures up to this point have just been disasters, pretty much, whether he knows it or whether it's plainly obvious or not. And like, it appears some good is coming out of it now, actually, through happenstance. And he gives a speech that's a little bit ridiculous, but a little bit heartfelt. And I'm curious to see where it goes next. I haven't quite gotten through this section, but it seems like there's something of a turn here. It's getting close to the end of part one. So the book was actually written in two separate parts. Which is fairly common, a lot, you know, not like intentionally serialized like Dickens did or, you know, several other books. Cervantes just had, I don't know if he had more to say originally, probably, and he probably did. And then, you know, just had book length. There's some notes in here about somebody wrote a sequel, an unauthorized sequel to Don Quixote.
Anyone can now, right? It's in public domain. So,
yeah,
you know, You can, he can be on that little ship with Steamboat Willie.
Yeah. This was in his time. There wasn't any copyright. But it's in part two, he actually responds to that or calls it out. You know, there's a little bit of meta text where, it's not quite fourth wall breaky, but Cervantes will kind of like obliquely refer to himself or to, you know, he's talking about Spain in a certain way. And, at one point, technically, like the part I'm at, it's, the original author had stopped writing and then the rest of this text is found. It is translated from like a, Arabic translation that was found. It's all bullshit. You know, it's a device to keep it going or whatever. That doesn't really matter in terms of, you know, what's going on in the book. Yeah. So I'm interested, you know, in what the differences in part two are going to be and, you know, checking out some of the other pop culture stuff. I think before this, the most I knew about Don Quixote was Don Coyote, the 80s Hanna-Barbera cartoon, which was along with Fantastic Max and some other whatever bullshit they were doing back then.
One of the more famous Don Quixotes on Broadway was Sir Richard Kiley, spare no expense, who you know as the voice of the computers in Jurassic Park. To bring it around to Jurassic Park.
Hey, fantastic.
has that come up on the show yet, or did we just talk about it extensively in the pre-show?
It just came up in the pre-show. I'm sorry. I can't go more than a half hour without mentioning it or I die.
Jim, you should start a pre-show tier on the Patreon.
It's not a bad idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wish that I could go back in time and give Cervantes Twine the scripting language. Oh, the video games he could have made with that meta text. He would be right at home.
You send him Mario Maker while you're at it.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. I think the other big modern book that this is reminded me of is A Confederacy of Dunces. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. Ignatius Riley's very, very much a quixotic character in the same way.
Well, you got to come back after you finish the book.
Yeah. That's why it's 5/12 to Don Quixote. I'm ensuring my lordship for future.
Yeah.
The remaining 7/12 of Don Quixote to be continued.
I'm pulling a big old Scheherazade on you.
Yeah.
Good.
Don't kill me.
In the meantime, I'm going to put out a secret podcast that's the sequel where I pretend to give the last 7/12 so that when John comes back on, he can be like, oh, no, that's not actually how it was.
Yeah. Have any of you tackled like giant these tomes or old books?
I'm in the middle of Gravity's Rainbow right now.
Oh, geez.
Speaking of a giant complicated tome, I love it. It's great. And I'm doing a real close reading and like underlining and looking in references and reading like a guide and stuff. But man, it is. I love it. I love a good, big, complicated book, but oof, it is like a thing where it is the opposite of pleasure reading sometimes.
Have you read any other Pynchon?
Yeah, I've read a couple others.
Did you start with Crying a Lot, 49?
Yeah. I think I read Against the Day years ago.
Yeah, both. I tried Crying a Lot, 49 and Gravity's Rainbow, and I kind of bounced off both. Like I was enjoying a lot of it. I know Gravity's Rainbow, I kind of bounced off after there's like an extended dream or hallucination sequence.
That's kind of racist.
That was pretty early on. Yeah, a little bit. You know, I kind of read a little bit after that. I had a copy and I just got rid of it. Maybe I'll try again someday. Crying a Lot, 49 takes place in Southern California. So I was like, yeah. Oh, hey, I know some of these places. Yeah. But I similarly kind of bounced off at a not quite a weird part. I don't know. I had it as an ebook and I got a ways into it, but I just dropped it for no reason.
I think it's pretty good. I think it's worth returning to because it's a lot shorter and I think a little more straightforward. And it really presages a lot of weird occult stuff. Speaking of the next topic, weird occult stuff that this is me doing a really good segue.
Let's do it. You can't just do a segue here. I have to call it out because that's the format. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
No, that's perfect.
Kevin, your topic is the Time Life Mysteries of the Unknown series, 1987 to 1991, and its impact on a generation of young nerds.
I was recently reminded of this because I saw one in like a thrift store and I actually should just go back and buy it. It wasn't the one I really wanted, which is why I didn't buy it at the start. But when I was growing up, my dad, I just turned 40 this year. So I was of the ages in the late 80s where, you know, the types of books that your dad and mom have on their shelf are like really like you instill a lot of like romance to them. And my dad had purchased, being a nerd himself, a series of books from the Time Life Corporation from this thing called the Mysteries of the Unknown series. And this was something where the Time Life Corporation...
You had encyclopedias too, right? Do you remember encyclopedias?
Yeah. Encyclopedias...
Do you remember like when it was a big deal that your parents had a bookshelf full of encyclopedias?
Not to say it nowadays, kids have it easy, but like Wikipedia is not the same. This is part of what I'm going to talk about with this Mysteries of the Unknown series, which is that Wikipedia supplanted this thing that was the bookshelf when you were young, like this bookshelf full of like just weird oddities that your parents had.
Yeah.
The Mysteries of the Unknown series, just to really quickly, the Time Life Corporation wanted to put out a series of heavily researched texts, and they weren't selling very well because they were things like on the Old West and stuff. And my dad had like a couple of these ones, like one on the pirates that I actually still have in the other room.
Yeah, my dad had the Old West set that was sitting on our bookshelf for many years.
But then in the 80s, they made a series on fairies that kind of was sort of popular, and they were like, what can we do now? And this was the late 80s, where it was like this resurgence of new age thought that culminated in this, like, there was just like a bunch of things happening with crystals and with, you know, new age that like led them to say, like, let's just go all in on a series that are just a bunch of new age things. We'll research the heck out of them. They're like really well researched for what they are, and put out these gorgeous books. And then we'll put a bunch of advertisements on television that are like kind of in the vein of Unsolved Mysteries, Robert Stack, like, you know, that was a show that was on a lot as a child in my house. And I have Robert Stack, his voice echoes in my head. But these commercials would be like, in 1947, a man went into the woods alone. He came back a different person. What happened in those woods? Read more in Mysteries of the Unknown, the UFO phenomenon. One of the famous commercials had a young Julianne Moore enacting one of these scenarios to advertise these. And these books were incredibly, they sold so well for Time Life. And if you go to the Wikipedia page and just read the names of them, you just want to read every one of them.
Yeah.
Mystic Places, Psychic Powers.
I was just doing that, in fact.
Yeah. The UFO phenomenon, psychic voyages, phantom encounters. Like, Phantom Encounters discusses encounters with mysterious apparitions, haunted families, banishing ghosts, and various ghost stories from Japan. They were international. They were like, it's hard to find them. There's not like PDFs of them that exist online. I have found a couple, but like, I just remember specifically the UFO phenomenon one being like a Bible as a child for me, just in terms of the amount of information it had about the history of UFOs in the world and mostly in America. And it's like, I just feel bad for kids these days. There's just not, this doesn't exist. I mean, YouTube has some of this probably, but like a full set, I think, would be a really good gift for people of a very specific age, 40.
Yeah. I never had these, but I did hang out in the 000 aisle. The Dewey Decimal aisle.
Yeah.
In the library, which was where you found books on both programming and ghosts. So it was just the best place to be.
The Shin Megami Tensei section.
I think that the Dewey Decimal system was invented by kind of an awful person, but he had no idea that the power of that was something that librarians would find exciting, school children would find horrible, and then a certain type of nerd would be like, oh, this unlocks the thing I want, which is the very specific niche of, like, for me, it was, I need to know exactly where the magic books are, where the books that teach you magic.
Yeah.
And so every time I'm in a library, zero in on those.
I never encountered these books out in the wild. I vaguely remember some of the ads, and I know I've seen, you know, people link them since. I'm looking, they were on Nick at Night. Yeah, of course I saw. But yeah, this kind of stuff was all over the place in book orders and things like that in school, you know, other kids getting interested into it. I wasn't like super big into it, but it was everywhere. You know, the X-Files premiered in the early 90s and Fire in the Sky. Those are kind of like, I consider those like big touchstones along with this stuff for that whole era.
Yeah.
It's very funny. I was mentioning this to my wife and she like gave me a big eye roll because I am very, very much skeptical, and especially about UFOs, right? There's a famous map that exists of like world UFO sightings. It might be wrong. It might be made up. It might be me just looking at it and going, oh, this is what I expect it to look like. But almost all of the UFO sightings that have happened in the world happen in America because, you know, we just want to believe, and we're very easy at going, oh, I saw something weird in the sky. It must be an alien. And like, it's very funny that I read these books as a child, which are well-researched, but very much in the vein of like, as opposed to this is all BS. Yeah. And I just, something must have happened between, you know, I want to believe youth child Kevin as Fox Mulder to becoming Kevin now as Scully.
Yeah, what happened is they stopped making Star Trek series for a while, so they couldn't tap anybody to host the TV shows that explored those things.
It like led me down like a bunch of really good rabbit holes. These are books that, like, if you are a person who thinks that Aleister Crowley is cool, these are the books for you. Like, they also are good in that they interview a lot of people who wrote books that, like, again, if you go to thrift stores enough, you will find these books. There's a book that's referenced in the UFO one about by this NASA scientist, I say as a NASA scientist, Joseph Blumrich, who wrote a book called The Spaceships of Ezekiel that's like tying biblical descriptions of a like Ezekiel's wheel to like, oh, that's an alien spaceship being described in the Bible, to here's how you would construct one. And like, God, I just, we used to be a country. We used to like allow for that sort of thing. And like, you could publish a book on that. As nowadays, it's just all on the internet. It's just not as fun anymore.
You could publish an ebook. You could ask ChatGPT to write you an ebook and then publish that as an ebook on Amazon. And make 50 cents, which is a profit.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, it would be, it's a step up from like the people who like print Wikipedia pages into an ebook and sell you that.
The thing about Wikipedia is that Wikipedia has like a house style, which I appreciate. I think Wikipedia is one of the great things the internet has ever done, but it's got a house style that is a little removed. And what I do like about these books and other of these is like, you read them if you are a rational being and go like, okay, I see this, but also like they like, there's a pulpiness to them that draws you in more than like, you know, I read Wikipedia like most people for fun in the way where you're like, oh, well, what's this? And then you go down a rabbit hole. But like, there's something about a physical book with photographs and pictures that has this pulpy style that draws you in. That's like, really, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it. You know, it's just, I
bet there's like simple, like vocabulary tweaks or grammar tweaks you could use to change the Wikipedia house style into like the style of a pulp novel.
Oh yeah.
Just like swap out certain words. I don't know. Change ending words ending in ing to ending in in apostrophe.
Just you go to ChatGPT and ask it for like some like sentences that don't mean anything but are kind of vaguely mysterious.
Yeah.
Like maybe at the end of a sentence it's but what if it wasn't? ?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you go to YouTube for this. The format nowadays is the iceberg memes.
Uh-oh.
Tip of the iceberg and things move down to deeper and deeper things.
Yeah. Let's see. I'm going to search for the JWST iceberg. There's nothing. I'm sorry. Oh, distant astronomical objects iceberg. So is this just astronomical objects sorted by distance? Is that what this is?
Oh, yeah, I guess. This was made by someone who doesn't exactly...
No, that makes perfect sense.
This is cute. Axis of Evil.
That'd be a funny subversion of the iceberg.
Yeah.
About looking at it. The easiest linear thing.
One of the books in the Time Life series is Spirit Summonings, which discusses mediums and seances. And I want to bring it up because I listened to a podcast a couple years ago called Ghost Church by Jamie Loftus, who did a podcast about joining Mensa and has written a book about hot dogs recently. But Ghost Church is kind of a history of the American seance movement, and it's friggin' great. It's super fun to listen to the history and also modern seance. Like, there's towns that are just like, you want to learn how to become a psychic? Here's where you go. And I just, I think that I have a lot of love, even if I'm very skeptical for that type of like hocus pocus mumbo jumbo stuff. And these books were very celebratory of that. And now I think that I'm going to just tell all my friends that in lieu of gifts for the next 10 years, just buy me one of the new copies of one of the books in this series.
Oh, that's so good. I love it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway,
I keep meaning to buy a box set of the In Search Of on DVD for family, mostly for Leonard Nimoy. But I mean, they're into all that kind of stuff too. So
yeah. Are we ready for another topic?
I think it sounds great.
Works for me.
My topic is Thomas Edison didn't think telephones needed to ring. He figured the caller could just start yelling hello at you before you even answered the phone.
Yeah, I do this. What's there to discuss?
Hello.
Hello.
The phone would be sitting there, and then you just hear the word hello from the phone.
Yes, from like the next room. And it would be loud enough for you to hear it from over there. I'm trying to find the quote I read.
Yeah, I mean, I think some people basically just do this, with Discord or Ventrilo or TeamSpeak.
I've always loved that Graham Bell wanted to use the term ahoy hoy. Like, I just think that that when we were trying to figure out, I mean, and Montgomery Burns, we were trying to figure out how phones would work and how phone conversations would work. I do like that multiple people have just had different ways.
No.
And I think in Japan, there is a term that is used generally as a phone greeting. I think it's mushmushi. I think that's like really, really great to like, you know, so Edison just assuming that like, you'd just be, the phone would be always on as a party line for everyone. Your friend would just start shouting hello and you'd be like, oh, great, my friend's calling.
So the quote is, it looks like a letter or perhaps a telegram. It says, friend David, I don't think we shall need a call bell as hello can be heard 10 to 20 feet away. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the phone system was a lot simpler then too, obviously. That feels like, you know, the step zero before you have operators and
right, yeah.
Things. You just have an always online. You know, it's basically a very fancy version of tin cans and string.
Right. It's just tin can and a swing, but with a battery attached.
Yeah.
It is much funnier to put it in a modern context. But yes, like owning a telephone back then was much closer to, like, you would only ever talk to other incredibly rich people.
Mm-hmm. Or scientists.
Probably you would know everybody who had a phone in the city. And if not, you would call them up to say hello and introduce yourself. Hello, fellow phone owner.
Yeah. What was the eternal September of the phone network?
enough people have phones that now it's not even like, oh God, everyone's just always talking about how cool it is to have a phone.
Yeah, and now it's ruined because of spam. So
I think that phones are an amazing piece of technology that we've had for 150 years, and now most youth don't want to use it because it's inconvenient and weird, and you know, they'd rather just send text messages. Essentially, we went from telegram to phone, and then we're just like, no, telegram, that's actually the peak. We want telegram back. Telegram with pictures, please. Thank you.
Both have their advantages, but yeah, it seems like we seesaw between which one's preferred.
I never answer the phone these days.
Is it because of spam?
No, it's usually it's someone who actually is trying to reach me, but I just like, I mean, it. Well, when I say someone, I mean like a company that I have a relationship with, such as my insurance company. They'll have something to say to me, and it's like, but it's usually like, you need to log in and read a message on our website.
I answer the phone pretty much every time, just because, I mean, if my phone tells me it's a spam thing, I go no. But mostly, if I don't know, worst case scenario, I'd get to talk to someone and, you know, breaks up my day a little bit. I also, I try very hard to remember that people are humans. Like, and so if someone's calling me, unless it's a computer or a robot or something like that, like, I tend to be like, well, let's just treat them like a person, because I think every other person who, you know, that they're calling, if it's like cold calling, it's just going to be the you know, some rude person or a hang up or something like that. So it's kind of fun to answer.
I appreciate that. I mean, part of my job involves talking on the phone. I don't do it as much as I probably should. Don't tell my boss. That's okay. Probably already knows.
Topic Lords has been your boss the whole time.
Yeah. But I have to, you know, I have to follow up with people as part of the job. And, you know, sometimes I'll just get a hang up and it's like, well, okay. You know, now I'm torn. Now I think I know what that means, but you know, I didn't get a definitive answer that you don't want to talk to me. So worst case for you is I get to follow up again and bother you a little bit more before I really get the hint. So
yeah,
I really do appreciate it when people say, sorry, we're not interested, you know?
Right.
It's not like I'm cold calling people, but
yeah.
Do you greet any particular people in your life in a funny way on the phone? Speaking of how we should indicate if the call is happening.
When I was growing up, my father would always answer the phone yellow. And I have picked that habit up such that sometimes people will call and think it, like when I was growing up and I would answer that, like when my voice went from my mother's vocal registry down to my father's vocal registry, I would answer yellow and everyone would start like, oh, Eric. And then they just start talking to my dad and I'd be like, nope, I tricked you.
Yeah. I got that for a bit when my voice starts to change too.
Yep. When I worked at EB Games right after high school, I was supposed to answer the question. This was back when F-Zero GX came out, and it was Thank you for, it would be, you have to answer, thank you for calling EB Games where you can get F-Zero for zero. My name is Kevin. How can I help you? And I would get bored and I would answer it, thank you for calling EB Games where you can get F-Zero for zero. And then I just, that would eventually became, let's see how long I can get someone to think that I'm a robot or a computer. And like, eventually the EB that I was working at got called by the like district or branch manager of like all or whatever, annoyed that we'd installed an one of these robot computer things without, you know, running it up the chain. And it was just me being like, you know, essentially like the Kramer, right? Like, why don't you press the number that you, like, why do you say the number?
You didn't have to sell Alfred Chicken.
No.
Okay.
Press one for store hours. Press two for, it was very fun because if you just sound authoritative, people will press numbers on their phone.
Yeah, they'll do lots of things if you just sound authoritative.
Yeah, that's how wars get started.
See the movie Compliance for more.
Yeah.
Do we have more on more about phones?
I don't think there's anything more to say about phones. I think we've
topic done.
Not tonight.
We've covered that entire field.
Maybe tomorrow they'll invent a new phone.
It's great that while trying to talk about phones, my own phone decided to
yeah let's lathe of heaven a new phone.
Are we ready for another topic?
Yes
For this topic we're going to be reading the poem Desiderata. Who would like to read this poem?
I'd love to. I think it's a very pretty poem.
This is my favorite kaiju. Just kidding.
Desiderata was written by Max Ehrmann in 1927.
Thank you. I was looking for that.
Yeah. But yes, this is from the original text where it was first published. Go placidly among the noise and the haste, and remember what peace there may be in silence. As far as possible, without surrender, be on good terms with all persons. Speak your truth quietly and clearly, and listen to others, even to the dull and the ignorant. They too have their story. Avoid loud and aggressive persons. They are vexatious to the spirit. If you compare yourselves with others, you may become vain or bitter. For always there will be greater and lesser persons than yourself. Enjoy your achievements as well as your plans. Keep interested in your own career, however humble. It is a real possession in the changing fortunes of time. Exercise caution in your business affairs, for the world is full of trickery. But let this not blind you to what virtue there is. Many persons strive for high ideals, and everywhere life is full of heroism. Be yourself. Especially, do not feign affection. Neither be cynical about love, for in the face of all aridity and disenchantment, it is as perennial as the grass. Take kindly the counsel of the years. Gracefully surrender the things of youth. Nurture strength of spirit to shield you in sudden misfortune. But do not distress yourself with dark imaginings. Many fears are born of fatigue and loneliness. Oof. Beyond a wholesome discipline, be gentle with yourself. You are a child of the universe, no less than the trees and the stars. You have a right to be here. And whether or not it is clear to you, no doubt the universe is unfolding as it should. Therefore, be at peace with God, whatever you conceive him to be. And whatever your labors and aspirations in the noisy confusion of life, keep peace in your soul. With all its sham, drudgery, and broken dreams, it is still a beautiful world. Be cheerful. Strive to be happy.
I was going to say, fortune cookies in the 1920s must have been gigantic.
Yeah. A couple of weeks ago, we did a poem called Poetry, which had a similar vibe to it in that it was written like in the early 20th century mm-hmm. and was basically prose. Except that I have this rule of thumb that I've come up with that like poetry is when you do something interesting with line breaks. But I think maybe a more interesting and maybe more useful distinction is poetry is when Jim's mind like goes spinning trying to figure out what the fuck this thing is saying. Because that one, even though it was basically prose, I was just like I couldn't get a grip on it. Like I was still trying to understand like three sentences ago while the current sentence was being read. But this one, it's definitely prose because like, oh yeah, it reads like that Wear Sunscreen song.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is something that you had pointed out.
It is an interesting, so this was, I think, written originally as one giant paragraph and it has been like line broken for ease of reading by other people. And it has had an interesting history in terms of copyright because people didn't know exactly where it came from and it caused people, it is now in the public domain, but like one of the more famous versions of this, Desiderata, is in the early 70s, speaking of the New Age movement, like a radio personality named Les Crane did a spoken word recording of it with like singers and stuff who kept singing, you should listen to it, Desiderata, Les Crane. Like the you are a child of the universe is like the chorus of it. You are a child of the universe. And like, it is effectively the 1970 version of Wear Sunscreen, Baz Luhrmann's Everybody's Free to Wear Sunscreen. It sounds almost identical in the choir singing with a male voice coming in and saying essentially a bunch of, you know, nice things to do and be. And it became very big in America and in Britain, and like actually charted this thing. It was so big that National Lampoon released their own parody version of it with the song and all this. And it was called like Desolada or something like that.
It looks like it's Deteriorata.
Yeah, Deteriorata.
Makes sense.
And if you really wanted to, you know, you could look up Deteriorata, the lyrics of it, and read that as a counterpoint. It starts out with, you are a fluke of the universe. You have no right to be here. Go placidly amid the noise and waste, and remember what comfort there may be in owning a piece thereof. Avoid quiet and passive persons unless you are in need of deep of sleep. Rotate your tires. It's, you know, I think that's like fascinating to think about, like this, you know, it's a very pretty poem. I think it has, as a person who thinks about being a child of the universe and the universe unfolding, I think a lot about these sorts of things. And it was fun to read, but I just love that it, you know, I went and listened to the song, the Les Crane song, and I was just like, this is great. This is such a new age hippie thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing this reminds me of is Polonius's speech to Laertes from Hamlet, where he's giving him a bunch of advice. Kind of as a list of advice, you know, neither a borrower nor a lender be should be on there, I think.
Oh, yes. For loan oft loses both itself and friend.
Yeah.
And borrowing dulls the edge of husbandry.
Do you think Baz Luhrmann has heard this speech?
Ladies and gentlemen of the class of 1263, a borrower nor a lender be. Those friends thou hast and their adoption. I tried to do a modern version of that once years ago. An incorrect thing to try and do. But I have a lot of love for Wear Sunscreen. Speaking of, there's a famous podcast that tracks its the entirety of that weird thing where Baz Luhrmann heard something he thought was Kurt Vonnegut's, but it turns out that it was like an Illinois, you know, newspaper column, the Wear Sunscreen. And how just like he was making Romeo and Juliet and had this Everybody's Free that he was and like just combined them. And then it became insanely huge and he toured around with it, trying to get people to play it on the radio and stuff. Like, it's a really fascinating thing to think about, you know, the history of these types of things. I wonder if there's a name, if any poets are listening, what is the name for this type of advice giving poem?
Oh, yeah. By the way, my understanding is that it is no longer considered to be solid, absolute science that you should wear sunscreen. The argument that I read was that vitamin D supplements don't work nearly as well as the sun does.
Oh.
And also that skin cancer is not that big a deal. It's very, it's extremely treatable.
Skin cancer is mid.
Yeah. Looking at, here's the National Library of Medicine. This is an NIH article, The Effect of Sunscreen on Vitamin D. Background, sunscreen use can prevent skin cancer, but there are concerns that it may increase the risk of vitamin D deficiency. Well, ladies and gentlemen of the class of 2024, don't wear sunscreen. The risks of skin cancer are wildly overrepresented in the media. Yeah. Please do not take any of what I'm saying as advice.
Conduct further experiments on the effects of gamma rays on man and the moon. Marigolds. Yeah. Sorry, I ran out of breath trying to say that.
There's a Spanish language version of the Desiderata song that was like made a year later, and it's equally as fun, like, because it's just a Mexican actor saying the poem in Spanish with a Mexican, you know, like Spanish choir. And like, it's just really, I just think that like this like weird time where, you know, music could be a poem. That's why it's cool that we got to live through a second weird time where a poem could be a hit song, right? I think we're overdue for one. We need another weird poem that becomes a song that like is inexplicably charting.
Yeah.
Now that the Billboard charts consider YouTube views when measuring how popular a song is, like Mr. Beast is going to be topping all the, like, as soon as they consider like any, not just a song, but any YouTube video.
Billboard Hot 100. Number one coming in, I give $100,000 to people who sleep on park benches by Mr. Beast. Yeah.
Is there a Casey Kasem for YouTube?
There should be. The fact that Casey Kasem did the voice for Shaggy is like super crazy to me.
Yeah.
What a range.
He was on Transformers until they did something very racist. And he quit in protest.
I didn't know that.
You know, he's of, I believe, is it Lebanese descent?
Oh, yeah. He believed the show contained offensive caricatures of,
yeah,
of people in Arab countries.
Yeah. And they had a country called Karbamya, a fictional country.
Oh, gosh.
Jesus.
Yeah. A few years ago, I was doing one of the voices in the TV cartoon series Transformers.
Yeah.
One week, the script featured an evil character named Abdul, King of Karbamya. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. I like my Casey Kasem impersonation. Yeah. I apologize to those listening.
That's okay. You know, I found a cheap DVD of the Ben Stiller show, the short-lived Fox sketch show.
Yeah,
and Casey Kasem pops up in it. It's like for a short-lived show, they got a lot of surprising guests on that. Tangent. It's a total time capsule of the early 90s. It's pretty wild. I need to finish watching it. There's only like 13 episodes or something, but it's
is that where Stephen Colbert and Steve Carell got their started?
I'm not sure. It's Judd Apatow's in it, Bob Odenkirk, Janine Garofalo, and Andy Dick.
I think I'm thinking of a different one. I think I'm thinking of the one that was the
Dana Carvey show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the most recent place I've stumbled upon Casey Kasem back from.
Desiderata, though, I think pretty good advice. I don't know. Avoid loud and aggressive persons.
I try.
Myself.
Especially when you need to sleep.
Yeah. Be gentle with yourself. I think that's like one of the more important bits of advice you could ever give someone, especially in the modern world.
I agree.
We are really hard on ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. Work on your self-compassion.
Mm-hmm.
You said hard on.
Are we ready for another topic?
Yes.
Kevin, your topic is pinball meant to be fun? Can you lose a quarter at an arcade game faster in a game cabinet or in a pinball machine?
I guess today's theme is things that were popular in the 70s and 80s. Pinball had like a real huge era. And I am so bad at pinball that it makes me think that it's just, there's no, like, are you just supposed to spend a lot of money to get good at pinball and like lose? Because like, I don't think there's any other way. Pinball is a game where you can pull the plunger, the ball goes up, it ricochets around, you get excited for a couple of seconds, and it just goes right between the paddles, and you're just like, oh, that's it for a ball. And like, that can happen like three times in a row. Like, in terms of game design, that's bad game design.
I have several things to say in response to that. One of them is, all those quarter, like all the arcade cabinet and pinball machines were every single one of them was tuned to like kick you off the machine in like 2 minutes at most. That was the established, like, yeah, you get about 2 minutes of entertainment for a quarter.
2 minutes.
That was their goal.
Wow.
And like, obviously some people got better at that, but they did so by spending a bunch of money. So nobody minded. Another thing is there's this effect where like when you have a long running game series, it has to get harder and harder to stay entertaining to the people who like those games. And I think that's been happening for like 100 years with pinball because those are all effectively the same game.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
So modern pinball is far, far more difficult than, you know, something from the 70s or something from the 60s or something.
I believe so.
By and large. And in terms of complexity, especially, I think it reached an apex in the late 90s, which is really the tail end of the second boom of pinball. You know, after Adam's Family did huge numbers, the 90s kind of like resurrected till it petered out in 2000 or so.
It was the Adam's Family specifically, that cabinet?
That was the most successful. You know, they were kind of on the wane through most of the 80s. Yeah. And then that was kind of like the last big boom.
Now that you're saying this, I went to a pinball museum in Delray Beach, Florida, a couple months ago. And it was one of these places where you give them $15 and everything's just free to play, which is the best way for me to play pinball because I don't feel that anxiety of like, oh no, I just lost my money and why did I do this? They had a whole history. So they had ones for the 50s and 60s. And like, I think I found that like when I was in the area that had some of the ones from like the early 70s or late, I was having the most fun. And then as I went to more and more modern ones, I was like, this is not fun anymore. And so maybe it is this thing where it just had to get harder and harder and harder because the people who were playing it were getting bored by the challenge.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when you go back to the roots of pinball, it obviously exists in the context of like penny arcades and stuff like that, which were designed to be simple amusements with no test of skill. You know, it was a fixed amount of time you used the thing or whatever amusement you got out of it. But you had the bagatelle machines and things like Baffle Ball where there were no flippers. It was just, you know, here's 10 balls. See if you can get a high score by, you know, plunging correctly. Right.
These were either secretly or perceived as, even if it wasn't true, gambling games.
Yeah, sometimes they very much were, and sometimes they did kind of like the pachinko thing where it was like, it's not gambling, but if you take this over to another place, that kind of thing, or like they'd give out free games and they consider that a point of gambling. There's a lot of history there, but yeah, it evolved. Steve Kordek put flippers at the bottom of the machine. Like Humpty Dumpty was the first machine that had flippers on it, but it had like six, like in a column, and they were facing outward kind of thing. So you could kind of keep the game going for a little bit, but the goal wasn't to like go as long as all that. And yeah, I mean, the thing you talk about with the ball just going right down the chute is a problem. But they did come up with innovations to prevent that, because that does feel bad. And that feels like so bad you don't want to put another quarter in. You're like, yes. Well, what the hell is going on here? Right. So, you know, there's like often a 30-second grace period or something like that, indicated usually with a flashing light right between the flippers or some other indication that you get it. You can drain it at least once. Some will let you drain it multiple times in that time.
This is never taught to anyone. Where do you learn that? I mean, you learn this by playing, but like,
yeah,
it's like a thing that I have played many pinball machines and I cannot tell you any of these things. Like I you know.
Yeah, they have this mechanic where like a ball goes into one of the gutters sometimes, like a little plunger will pop it back out.
Yeah, kickback.
Kickback.
Most of these things have names after a while. I mean, the terminology is developed over years and years.
Nerds come up with terminology for Arcana?
Yeah, I
know.
Yeah, I mean, kind of an early example on the old electromechanical machines. I'm blanking on the name, but there's a boxing-themed pinball game. But there's like a metal guard that's there until you get a certain number of points. And the flippers are really wide on that machine. So I think the goal is to kind of like set things up as much as possible. Anyway, so yeah, there's been a lot of push and pull in terms of mechanics and, you know, what to do with players. So there have been things like that. And they certainly designed these things with that sort of thing in mind. If you've ever played like Pinbot or Star Trek The Next Generation, you'll know they have particular outlanes that seem like they're magnetic and designed to just capture any stray ball that comes near them. They're not magnetic, but they are designed in such a way that, yeah, they're probably going to go out if they approach that and you don't respond accordingly.
That's annoying.
Yeah. But there are, you know, there have been mitigation techniques. There's like Magna Save. So you can earn the ability to, a lot of the time you earn or turn on an ability for either a limited number of uses or a limited number of time that can prevent against that sort of thing. Black Knight has that, where you can earn magnet saves. The thing is, you have to be able to react. You have to see, oh, it's going toward the outlane. I don't want to risk a tilt or whatever. So I'm going to press the button in case it goes out there. And then a magnet will drop it into the inlane instead.
Let's talk about tilt for a second. By the way, so the answer to your question of whether you can lose an arcade game, like a arcade cabinet or a pinball game faster, definitely pinball, because you can tilt it.
Yes.
Yeah.
That might be the quickest way to lose money. Besides just throwing it in the gutter.
Is there an arcade machine with a tilt? They should have put those in because people...
That's a good idea.
You can't get any better at them by tilting. It doesn't do anything, but people will bang the machine. It's like... just use it as an anti-abuse measure.
Right.
I'd love to see how the tilt is calculated within a machine. Like, you know, in modern ones, it's just an accelerometer, but like...
Yeah. I'm sure it's like a ball bearing in a bowl, and when it makes contact with something on the side...
Yeah, I think a lot of the time it was a plumb bob that would, you know, just kind of hang inside a metal ring.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
And it makes contact. So you can let it rest for a bit and then it'll go back, you know. And there's like adjustable tilt settings in the machine of like how aggressive can it get.
How big the ring is. So, yeah, talk about tilt, because this is a way to address the problem of the ball going straight down the middle and you can't do anything about it.
Yeah. So tilt is the condition where, you know, you've hit the machine too much.
Well, I mean, talk about hitting the machine. Like,
yeah.
Like you're expected to at least a little bit, like nudge it around.
That's something that's not also explained very well because
it's not explained at all.
You get it from context from like, I don't know, watching TV shows about pinball or movies.
Yeah.
But like the thing you said that's key about tilt is that, and this is why I can't be just like, if it's a plumb bob, like it's something where in my head, maybe I'm wrong. It like the machine's like, you can push me around a little bit. But if you do it enough, no. Like, and what is it that's like telling you, like, you're pushing me a little? Okay, now, no. Is it like force of?
Yeah, as a physical game, every pinball machine's a little different. I mean, even arcade games are like this. There's dip switch.
Even with the same like cabinet, like different iterations of it are different instances of it are different.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it's down to operator settings. It's adjustable on site, you know, whether you want to make the game harder or easier, depending on what your players are doing and everything.
But also just like, how old are the servos?
Yeah, there's physical degradation to consider as well, which is another little wrinkle. So like if you get a high score on a pinball machine, it's Foursquare. It's like the Foursquare. Right. You're the king of this machine now.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to like the game in general. But obviously they have pinball tournaments and stuff where, you know, everybody's competing on the same play field, quite literally. But for how to get better, I mean, I was not like super into pinball. And then Farsight Studios put out the Pinball Arcade.
Yeah.
Pinball Hall of Fame, the Williams collection. So they had two games called Pinball Hall of Fame beforehand. Mm-hmm. One came out on the Wii and then got ported a little bit later. But they kind of merged it all in this philosophy with Pinball Arcade, which sadly they lost licenses to a bunch of the real tables and you can't get them anymore. But obviously you could play for free at home. And they had an extensive rules section for each table. And, you know, later on, eventually tips from pro players on specific machines. So a lot of it is context, but things like tilt became built in to the machine. Like you would get tilt warnings, right? So the machine actually warning you tells you something about it. I've never been good at nudging, but that's...
What's interesting about pinball also, looking at a bunch of them, is seeing the development of like the things that I consider the fun thing in a pinball machine, which is those crazy metal loop-de-loops and, you know, like various alleys that go up into things such that lights go. And like, that's something where if I was designing a pinball game, I would make it so you could do that thing more.
Yeah.
like the thing I like most about pinball is what you said. It's like this, there's this weird kinetic sculpture that exists just for my entertainment. Which is amazing.
Yeah. Y'all might like the Pinball Circus if you ever get a chance to play it. There were only a couple of prototypes made. It never went into full production. But one of them is available to play for the public at the Las Vegas Pinball Hall of Fame.
Oh, looking at this, it does look pretty cool.
Yeah, it's wild. It's like a multi-level, like it's mostly vertical. It's like a three-level table. And your ball, like, you know, climbs up the trapeze or an elephant picks it up and, you know... it never made it production because it's super complicated and probably pretty kind of slow to play. But
that's the one with a talking marionette in it.
You might be thinking of Funhouse.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. That's another popular table.
I played one in Delray Beach at the Pinball Museum there. That was the Black Hole, which for personal reasons, and it has at certain points. I never got this to trigger because I'm awful at pinball, but they had another play field that was tilted at a different angle underneath the play field you're on. So the ball would go down and suddenly you'd have to invert your thinking such that the paddles were putting the ball back up towards you because it was inverted a black hole gravity thing, which is a very clever. I think that there's a huge amount of cleverness. The issue I think with pinball is that unlike any other game, it is reliant on gravity. It would play differently on the moon or Jupiter, and because it's reliant on gravity, it's reliant on how you tilt things and how everything and it's reliant on the randomness of the bumper smacking things around. And that allows for like a difficulty dispersion that I think is too high for the average player. You can tune in making your Pac-Man, you know, you can tune it to be like, oh, let's make the difficulty dispersion very narrow. So it's a certain level of difficulty without incredible high, you know, until you get far enough in the game, right? But I'm sad that to hear this, like, I think like, oh, 2 minutes, it's 2 minutes. They want to get you out, take your quarter, and then give you 2 minutes of entertainment for that quarter. Cause like that limits them with the way you make games, right? From a game design perspective, pinball's lame.
Yeah. And that's why I'm so glad that games got past the arcade.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, and they want that for average player. You can have good games and bad games too.
Yeah.
And both in terms of the games you're playing and both in the pinball design.
Someone should make a very boring and easy pinball cabinet. That's just, you can sit there for 45 minutes and just no one's there. Like, everyone's like, okay, I'm done with this.
That's called Pokemon Pinball Ruby and Sapphire for the Game Boy Advance. It's very charming, but I think I owned that for 2 days, but this was before I was like super into pinball. And I'd caught Jirachi like 4 times, on the second day. So I still haven't caught Mew on Pokemon Pinball, the original. I have a saved game going. I was fighting against Mew on the verge of capturing it, and I failed one time. I still have a ton of balls in the game, but I say have. This was like a couple years ago. I was so distraught after missing that opportunity that I saved the game. And I said, okay, I'll pick this back up later. I still haven't for a couple of years. So quite a difference in the contrast there. Before we run out of time, if you, Kevin, or anybody else want to learn a lot more about pinball design and philosophy before the Pinball Arcade came out and actually started playing some of these tables, including Black Hole, which is actually, I think, still one of the ones available because Pinball Arcade still has the Gottlieb license. And while they're not like the top tier, they were like the other big major pinball manufacturer, and they have a lot of good games too. Black Hole is definitely one of them. And Haunted House is kind of a sequel that does the same thing with the lower play field. But the documentary Tilt, the Battle to Save Pinball, it was an indie documentary that came out. I bought the DVD when it came out, and there was a special edition with a second disc with a ton of bonus material. So the documentary itself is really great. It's about Pinball
2. Multi-disc.
It's about Pinball 2000, which was, you know, the neat little Pepper's Ghost magic trick they did to kind of reinvigorate pinball with a sequel to Attack from Mars and then the Star Wars Episode 1 pinball machine. Those were the two that released. So if you've seen one, you've probably seen the Episode 1 pinball machine. If you haven't, you should look it up. But the bonus disc on that, as good as the documentary itself is, has a lot of extensive interviews with some of the top pinball designers from the 90s. Most are still working, actually, for Stern, you know, on kind of like a freelance basis. Stern's a big pinball manufacturer now. A few other smaller ones have popped up to really fill in. So it's popular now more than ever. But like designers like George Gomez and Pat Lawler have extensive interviews there. And at least in the old Pinball Arcade, you can find Pinball Hall of Fame. You can still find disc versions of both of them out there for like PlayStation 4 and then Pinball Hall of Fame for earlier systems. There are a number of tables for both of them, and you really get into the different philosophies that different designers have for pinball. So if you like flow, look for tables by George Gomez. If you like those rails and hitting those ramps, Medieval Madness, Monster Bash, and some others he's done. Steve Ritchie's another one. He's actually the voice of Shao Kahn in Mortal Kombat. He does Midway Williams and all that. It's like pinball and arcade were under the same roof. So a lot of these guys are, Ed Boon's the voice of Rudy on Funhouse. He's the voice of the marionette.
Right. Yeah.
George Gomez did Tron. Oh, one of my favorite looking arcade cabinets of all time is the original Tron arcade cabinet. I mean, as a big Tron fan. So
yeah.
Well, this is, you are exactly the right people to ask my question of, is pinball meant to be fun? Apparently the answer is yes. We've solved it, folks.
Oh, it's meant to, it's not actually though. It's, but they tried.
Yeah.
It's meant to be fun for a certain kind of person. Well, it's at least meant to be fun for a bit.
For the pinball wizard.
Yeah. We could use more entertainment that's fun and then stops being fun instead of trying to keep you addicted for years.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a sweet spot for pinball for sure. It's somewhere above the 2 minutes the arcade operator wants you there. My other advice is a lot of pinball machines have settings where if you put in like $2 or $5, you get some extra games for, you know, that you wouldn't get if you're just feeding it a dollar at a time. So look out for that. I spent a lot of time at a Godzilla machine recently for not a lot of money. The other big secret is they're in places like the Free Play you mentioned and barcades where they're loss leaders, right? So
yeah. Well, I recommend the Silver Ball Retro Arcade and Pinball Museum in Delray Beach. I had a lot of fun. I also, they have like open ski ball, which is like, you know, one of my great pleasures.
That's if I could find free play ski ball, I don't want to redeem tickets. I just want to practice on that. Yeah.
Yep.
That's a similar vein for me and you and pinball. Yeah.
Yeah. In the Bay Area, there's a, it used to be called Lucky Juju. Now it's called the Pacific Pinball Museum. It's in Alameda Island.
Yep. And then there's also the Musée Mécanique, which has some older machines.
Oh, yeah. That's great. I haven't been there in a long time. Mm-hmm. That's all the time we have for Topic Lords.
Yay!
Woo! We did it!
John, if this is something that you want, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on the Topic Lords Discord. I'm on Blue Sky. I'm still hanging around on Twitter, @youoldso-and-so, pretty much in all those places. So, you know, I'm slowly kind of transitioning off of Twitter. The DM functionality and some of the people over there, I can't lose it completely, but
I understand. Yeah. I forgive you.
Thank you.
and Kevin, if this is something that you want, where can people find you on the internet?
Yes, I'm in a similar boat. You can still find me on Twitter. I very rarely post on there. I also have Blue Sky. The Twitter one is Kevin_Hainlein, and the Blue Sky is what? @KevinHainlein@bsky.social. And ostensibly I have a Mastodon instance somewhere, but I never use that. And it's also ostensibly have a co-host instance, but rip co-host maybe, you know.
Co-host is like, I think they're going to be okay. At the very least,
I hope so.
It'll keep running. They'll just stop adding features.
Is there some updates? I remember the kind of
the latest is that they are running out of funding, but they have enough income to pay for one developer, just not four developers, which is what they currently have.
Right.
I think Cohost is the one I would like to use the most. Like, if I had more free time, if I was younger, I read a really good set of articles about the history of Magic the Gathering on Cohost that made me like really get into this thing, this idea of Cohost as a long form blogging platform. But I also have Instagram under my name, but like, who cares? Mostly just go look up Jade's stuff. Look at JWST images of faraway galaxies. They're pretty cool.
Thanks so much for being on.
Yeah.
Thanks as always.
Thanks, Jim.
Hi, this is Jim. This is the audio I append to every episode of Topic Lords. Congratulations to our newly anointed lords. This episode was edited by Esper Quinn, who can also edit your episode if you contact them on Twitter. If you'd like more people to hear the show, you can tell your friends about it, or rate and review us on whatever podcast service you use. You can add content to the Topic Bucket by emailing topicbucket@topiclords.com, and you can contribute to our Patreon at patreon.com/topiclords. Patrons get episodes a week early, and you get access to the Topic Lords Discord, where you can discuss topics with all the lords that hang out in there. See you next episode!